All right, welcome to the Haggadah Shir, Tavshin Pei Aleph. Can't believe we're ready. Tavshin Pei Aleph and by Pesach. I want to discuss a theme about finding and creating our own Haggadot, making our own Haggadah. What's that all about? So, the idea I want to share with everyone is basic, but really want to try to elaborate, draw out this simple but beautiful concept of what Haggadah is really about. It's more than just an old story of what was and a vision of what will be. Emir Hashem soon in our days, coming the month of Geula, from Geula to Geula. But I really want to create, drawing out the sparks of in our neshamot, figuring out those stories, and what's the dream? What's the vision of La'ati Lavo that we're really thinking about on Seder night? Okay, so I'm not using the presentation too much. I'm going to really say a lot of thoughts that I have on my mind about the Haggadah, and it comes from the Lashon. Agadah or Haggadah is a Lashon Lahagid, to draw out. Agid is something that's drawn out. And that's really the point of that Chazal put into Haggadah by calling it Haggadah, something that's like a story. And a story often is lahagid, lamshoch halev, to pull the heart, to draw a person in. So let's figure out what's really all the story is about, and what do we, how can we make it more personal? How do we write our own? Everybody has to be able to write their own Haggadah at the end of time, that they could be able to give over to their children, to tell them, sit down at the Seder, we're going to say my story, all hashkacha, prati, things that happened to me. So I read a lot of beautiful things. I'm going to start with just a few, and then we'll draw them closer to the Haggadah story. I just said this last night, but just to get it started, just a chazara real quick. The Chafetz Chaim was once approached by someone who was learning for a long time, and said he felt despair because he just learned that the Zohar said a person learns Torah and does mitzvot, and he doesn't do them with purity of heart. He's learning because he has to, or because he's going to get a reward. He gets a sticker in his classroom, or he's going to get a prize, or he gets money if he works or learns. So for his mitzvot, they're not so pure. So you know what it says in the Zohar? So it says it doesn't go to Shemayim. He gets paid back in this world. Those mitzvot don't count so much. So he felt terrible. He said, I'm doing the mitzvot, but I'm not going to get real reward in Shemayim. So it says the Chafetz Chaim, I'll tell you a story. Once I was in a town in Russia, and I met a baker, and every day he was always upset. Well, I asked him why, so he told me because originally when I went to, when I always wake up in the middle of the night, I work backbreaking labor to get the wood, to fuel the furnace, and cook those breads. And then I'm working, working, working until 6 in the morning, and then guess what happens? I have 30 loaves, and I've been shaping each one and working really hard to make those breads. And then the bakery people come and they're nitpicky and they say, oh, I don't like this one, got scorched, this one rose too much, this one's misshaped. No, not this one, not that one. You know, people could be picky. And then I'm left with a dozen rolls nobody buys. And all I get it for the whole day of work that I did, I woke up in the middle of the night, is complaints. That's why I'm sad. That's why I'm annoyed. For my hard work, what do I get? A few years later, the Chafetz Chaim comes back to town, sees this baker, and he sees he's really happy. He says, no, what happened? Everybody's depressed. It's the middle of World War I. So he said, this baker, he said, you know, something totally turned around for me. And within the war, my suppliers decided I was really an essential distributor. They gave me some wheat. I made the bread. There was never, I didn't get one complaint. I wake up really early in the morning. I'm making my bread. You know, they're a little misshaped. They're not perfect. Every single one of them flies off the shelf and everybody just gives me a thank you. Said the Chafetz Chaim, when the Zohar was written, so Hashem said, look, I'm only taking the Torah that's really pure. The mitzvot are absolutely with Avad Hashem. Says the Chafetz Chaim, but now in our day, what's left? We're in a time of big struggles, a competition with tremendous culture that we have to compete with. That's the time when Hashem says, any Torah, the misshaped ones, the ones that are a little burnt on this side, the ones that are not perfect Torah learning, it goes straight up to the Kisei HaKavod. So with that introduction, that's just a chizuk, what is the everything we have to be putting our heart and effort into that really make a big, big difference. I read another point. This is new. That was last night. Everybody was there last night. That was Chazara. Here's the new stuff. You heard that? Great. If you did, here's new. I saw that And this is from Rav Pesach Kron. He had a story from a family that moved from Bukharia, from a Sephardi family to Israel, the Mirav, and the parents came and they moved to Israel. They had one child and they moved to America, had more children, lived in Queens, Forest Hills, and they were traditional, of course, Sephardi, Bukhari, and of course they have big Ben Ish Chai picture, 3 feet tall, whatever, on their wall, beautiful, but they don't know all the Torah, they don't know all the things, but they're very, very traditional. So the mother has two now baby children, small little kids. She's trying to find and this is many years ago, trying to find a good yeshiva for her kids. Good. So she has no idea how to find a good yeshiva for her kids. So she looks up in the yellow pages for schools. So she sees school, Jewish, good. She calls the phone number and they say, "Oh, please come in. We'll give you a tour of our school." She comes in, she sees the principal, and she says, "Hello." He says, "I'm a rabbi." She says, "I see you don't have a beard." He says, "No, in our country, we don't do beards anymore." And she walks around and she says, "Where are the kippot?" Not everybody wore kippot. She walked out. Said, "What was going on with that school?" I said, "Oh, that." And someone else, finally, she gets in front, talks to a friend. "No, that was a conservative school. So why don't you try a different yeshiva?" Okay. She finds another yeshiva. She calls them on the phone. They say, "Oh, sure. Come in. This is an Orthodox place. Yeah, we'll be happy to take you for a tour." So Ms. Meirav goes in to this yeshiva, and the rabbi, who was the name? Rabbi Gedelzer. Gedelzer. Anyway, Gedelzer is showing them around, beautiful, and it's a very Ashkenazic yeshiva. They mostly speak a lot of Yiddish. This was years ago. It's a lot of Yiddish. And he could tell after walking them around, they're from Israel, they're from Uzbekistan, they're Sephardi. The kids are not going to know any Yiddish. They're not going to have background in the culture with the other kids. So after walking around, touring, and the mother is so excited. She's in all the posters in all the rooms, there's Aleph Bet. The kids are all wearing kippot. She sees the principal with a big beard. She says, "I really, really want to send our kids to this yeshiva. This definitely reminds me of the tradition. I want to send." And Rabbi Gedelzer says, "I'm a little sorry, but maybe I'll give you good people to refer you to. I see you're from the Sephardi tradition. Your children might not be familiar with the Yiddish. Some of the teachers here speak." And before he finished his sentence, he saw Mrs. Meirav was starting to cry. She was thinking, "I came, I tried making such an effort. I want my kids to get a good Torah education." Before he finishes the sentence, he says, "And although it's going to be a challenge, I'm going to accept your children right away." And from that, before he turned them away, he decided to change his mind and he accepted them. Happened to be those two Sephardi boys started an organization, Chazak. It's an organization, Macy's sometimes, whatever. They have a lot of shiurim every now and then in the New York area. But one of them got smicha as a rabbi now, and he has stuff on YouTube also. He speaks about Torah education always. But Lamaisa, those precious tears of that Mrs. Meirav made such a small, that 1 minute of dedication and consideration, the fact that she put in so much effort and care made all the difference. And that small difference that she made in that 1 minute made a difference for her children, which education they're going to be able to get. And I made a difference for the organization that kid started. Chazak has shiurim all over the world, all over the year. And no doubt has an impact on her grandkids. So everything we do now is, you remember, the Haggadot we're creating now are not just impacting us today, are impacting our children, are impacting the rest of our lives. We have to make sure to impact ourselves as much as we could right now. Take those neshamot, those precious, precious sparks that we have, ignite them, and draw out as much as we could in getting connected with the stories of the Haggadah. Okay, so I have another incredible story of that was a story about every tear is worth a tremendous amount. Now here's a story to get us into the flavor of the Haggadah, and then we'll go through some of the parts of the Haggadah with different points and stories. And I'm going to say some other stories about Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky. I'll say some stories about him and some things that he said over. He was a Magid in Yerushalayim. He's not the one that the Magid Speaks was written about. Anybody ever heard of that book, those books before, Magid Speaks? Those are at Pesach Kron. They're mostly about stories that he heard from Rabbi Shalom Shadron. A very good speaker, and I love some of his stories. Very nice and warm stories. This was another Magid in Yerushalayim, Rabbi Galinsky. Rabbi Shadron was from a little bit of Hasidim, from the Maharsham. He always had a nice touch. Rabbi Galinsky came from a different world. He learned in pre-World War II Europe. He learned in the Vardic. When the Nazis came into a certain part of Ukraine, they tried escaping. They got caught by the Russians. They got sent to Siberia. Him and a few of his friends. The ones that weren't killed, they were sent to Siberia for terrible labor. And they were working 14 hours a day with no coats on below freezing weather. Below zero, not below the freezing, below zero weather. So if we feel pain when we're a little outside with the corona things, or if we can't be inside quite as much with good heating, I can only imagine what Eric Galinsky was feeling then. Is that some people didn't make it through those winters in Siberia, and they're working 14 hours a day, and they got very meager rations. So it was probably better what the Nazis gave, but it wasn't too much better in Siberia. And he said there was no meaning to their work. They just chopped wood and gave it, sent it to the Russians, and there was nothing else they were doing. And he said there was a friend he had that used to be his friend in Novartek, and he got a special privilege. The Russians liked him a little bit. He was sent off to Siberia to a work camp, but he was allowed to work in the kitchen. If you worked in the kitchen, you could be a little bit hot, and you get a little bit of food. He said there was no rations. It wasn't a small little piece of bread and water for the day, like the rest of the workers. You can work in the kitchen and get a normal amount of food. He said this friend he had decided upon himself, whenever the meals came and everybody got a tiny little block of bread that was stale, this friend took the same thing. He never took another bite from any of the other food, even though he's in the kitchen all day. He said, how can I give out food to other people and I see them starving, and I'm not going to be in the same boat as them? He couldn't do that to himself. And Rabbi Galinsky said he really learned what it meant to have Ahavat Yisrael, to feel the pain of another Jew, to not even take something that you feel you need, because you don't want to put yourself in a comfortable situation when you're. How can you enjoy things when someone else is in pain? That idea is for sure embedded in we have in the Sefer Yisim Mitzrayim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was running the world, and Hashem saw the Jews in pain, and Hashem took a brick, so to speak, and put it by the Kisei HaKavod with the children that were Chas V'Shalom put into the bricks of the walls that the Egyptians made us forcefully do. Hashem took it and used it for his Kisei HaKavod. Hashem has that in front of him all the time. Moshe Rabbeinu went out to go see his brothers. There was none of the Levim used regular names for their kids. They would use Kahat. Kahat is chattering the teeth. Miriam, bitterness. Why they named their kids bitter? They'd probably get made fun of school because of that. Because they couldn't see their brother in go through terrible pains and not feel pain for them. One story about Rabbi Tumim and then one of Rashash. In 1800s, Rabbi Baruch Tumim, one of the commentators on the Gemara, one time he heard he had a son, Eliezer, and one time he was coming back from yeshiva, and then someone told him, Eliezer is sick. So he thought his son is sick, so he comes to his house and says, no, what's going on with his wife, what's going on with Eliezer? And he said, and she says, nothing's wrong. And there's an Eliezer, and the other across the town is sick. And he says, oh, I feel. So first he said, I feel relieved. And then he said, how could I possibly feel relieved? Is another Jew. Another Jew is in pain. I can't possibly feel the same way. I have to feel just as sad as I feel for my children, for other people. And once, it was another type of situation, just in that same family, Rabbi Tumim, there was a person that was sick on the other cross of town, And there was people in his house laughing, just about a regular joke. And he said, "How can you be laughing at this time? There's somebody in critical condition that you have to be praying for." And in fact, it came out they broke a shidduch. There was somebody, not broke a shidduch, someone tried to give a suggestion to his daughter and said, they were laughing at a time when someone was sick. And he said, "How could you be laughing?" And he said, "I don't want to have our family marry into a family that doesn't care about Jews." So to such a degree, the Gedolim has such a concern and pain for our fellow Jew. Now, I'll move on to the story of the Rashash, but introduce one of the concepts of the Seder. The thing we are just bringing out is every small action, the Chafetz Chaim tells us, goes up straight to the Kisei Kavod. Concern for fellow Jews, Rabbi Galinsky was telling us about, is so, so critical. That's a Pashut idea that we have in the Seder. Here's one of the other very critical themes before we dive into some specific parts, is Yasu B'Rechush Gadol. Look, Hashem gave us an amazing package, that we got a lot of money, a lot of the jewelry we took from Yamsuf and we took it with us. We had them from Brit HaBayim. Anybody know why did Hashem give us a big rechush gadol, so much wealth? Why did Hashem give us so much money? Do we really need it? We had free meals, the man. We had good laundry service with the clouds of glory. We had nice heating service with the clouds. We really needed all that money. What was the point of the money? It caused the chayda egel that we spent all that gold on the chayda. What was the point of having so much? Why did Hashem give us the money? Any answers? Remember from Rashi, any ideas? Why do we want so much money? Oh my, I can't hear. Someone will have an answer. Okay. Remember, there's a story.
When they're going to enter the land of Israel, they're going to need money to build, to buy, to korbanot.
Practical. That's a great answer. Okay, let's go back, go in history, back to Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu was given. Ah, another answer. The Jews were for 215 years, they got ripped off. They didn't ripped off. They were beaten and cruelly enslaved. Okay, very good. But let's remember back to the days of Avram Avinu. Hashem gave him a promise. He said, Inu v'avdum v'inu otam arba me'ot shana. You guys are going to work 400 years, but Eretz Lo-Lahem. It's somewhere else, foreign land. You're going to be enslaved, a hard time. But you know, Yesu b'Rechush Gadol. So Hashem said, I don't want Ota Sadiq, that big Sadiq Avraham, to come to me after all those years and tell me I didn't keep my word. So please, go take some of their wealth. Still, Avraham Avinu is going to complain to Hashem that we didn't get it, Hashem didn't fulfill the promise.
No, it doesn't answer the question still. Even though Hashem promised it, the question is, why did Hashem promise that we would wish foolish kind of, what good would it have done?
That's even better. I love that question. So here's an answer. The Rashash, a big gadol living in the 1700s from Teman, the Rishon Sholarabi. If you ever see a Sidur, it's filled with Kabbalah all over. The Rashash Sidur, he is on the Gemara commentary.
Well, I have a question. I have just a quick comment on that. The Rashash Sidur, years ago, I went to the student of Rav Kaduri, Rav Darzi, who my father-in-law introduced me to, who's buried next to Rav Kaduri. He was Rav Shmuel Darzi, was a prime student of his. And I went to his yeshiva after being at Nets at the Kotel at 4:30, and I asked him to please purchase the Sidurim that they use with all the Kabbalah, three pages of Kavanot before you get to Shema, you know, Hashem, Kavanot before of the first Hashem, the Amidah, all that. And I go, I'll pay $50, whatever. He goes, no. I go, please, I'll give you $100, 300 shekel for the. He goes, no, tarikh lilmod. He wouldn't sell it to me.
Wow. So one time they have it around, it's such an amazing chashivud of the, we have to appreciate. Yeah, there's so much to appreciate by the Kabbalah. The Rashash was usually very much into his learning. And he learned with a lot of focus. When he was in the middle of learning, he wouldn't focus on other things. One thing that he was involved with is Gamach, a free loan society. It was a big chesed he would do, a kindness for other people that needed small businesses that needed loans, or people that couldn't afford things. They needed money. So he would lend them money for free, and they pay him back. This is very simple. This is often how things go. And it is a big chesed he would do, be involved with. One time, he lent that money to somebody, and he was in the middle of learning, and this person comes, knocks on his door, comes in, gives him the check that he's repaying, or gives him the money, gives him an envelope with the money that he's repaying, and as the Rashash continuing learning in his Sfarim, he takes the money and slips it into his Gemara, in the back of the Gemara, between the pages and the binding, it's the mutar, it's not in the middle of the Gemara, okay? So he puts it in between, and he forgets about it because he's in the middle of learning. He just saw this person said hello, took it in, put it in, kept learning. A little while later, he's looking at his accounting books and checking who he gave loans out to, and he says, oh, there's an outstanding loan from so-and-so, because he never marked it off that it was paid off, because he was in the middle of learning, so he wasn't dealing with anything. He just took the money. He didn't remember. And it was a little while later, he didn't remember that it happened. So he said, he called the person over, and he said, oh, I realized I lent you money, and you never paid back. He said, no, I did pay you back. And he says, I'm sorry to do this to you. It's not really my money. It's a gemach. It's a charity fund we have for the community. So I need you to pay back. So he says, I did pay back. He said, okay, let's go to Beit Din, and let's see what they're going to say. And before they went to Beit Din, this person, I think, had a grocery store in the town. Unfortunately, because everybody started saying Lashon Hara about this person, everybody said, this person doesn't believe the Rashash. This person is trying to get away with lying and borrowing it from money and never paying back. Everybody says, we're boycotting a store. So this guy started losing business. And the Rashash says, you know what, maybe let's reconsider about the Beit Din. He says, I'm stuck at this point. I can't do anything. My business got destroyed because everybody said Lashon Hara about this. The person, this guy, unfortunately, terribly sad, he moved out of town. He closed his shop. He couldn't make any money because of all the Lashon Hara that was said. And no one knows exactly what happened, but he moved somewhere else far away. Years later, Rashash was learning the same thing in the Gemara, and then he got to the last page, he opened the envelope, and he sees the name of the guy, and it's the exact amount of what he loaned him. He goes back to the accounting book, and he sees, oh wow, it really was paid off. It's paid off all those years ago. I feel terrible. I ruined that guy's life. What am I supposed to do now? It's such a sad, terrible thing. What do we do to that type of situation? The Rashash had an idea. So he went, he tried, there was no yellow pages in the middle 1700s. He tried finding out from friends which town he moved to. He found out more information, and he found that whole person. And he said, I really, 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 really want to apologize to you. He says, what do you mean apologize? I had a life, I had friends, I had a business, I had a shul, I had everything, I had trust, I had a reputation. It's all gone. Everybody, after one time I didn't pay you back, and people thought I didn't pay you back, I did pay you back, because that one mistake you made, it ruined my life. Everybody. So he said, look, I can get you everything back. He said, look, we'll let you back, move it back into town, we'll get you a new shop. He said, guess what also? I know you have a son, it's a marriageable age, and I have a daughter, marriageable age. We'll make a shidduch. And the person said, now this is when you do arrange marriages in Tehman in the 1700s. So they made a shidduch, and it worked out very successfully. Baruch Hashem. Now, the Rashash didn't really cause all that Lashon Hara. Baruch Hashem, that's a good ending to our story. Did he really need to marry off his daughter to the son? I'm assuming the daughter was obviously happy with it. The answer is, could he have just said, sorry, please be mochel me? That he didn't really mean to do anything wrong. The answer is, in theory, yeah, he could just say sorry. Saying sorry sometimes works, but he said, there's a tremendous difference between a sorry and what he did. Saying sorry is not going to bring back that guy's dignity. Can't recreate his life. He's lost. He lost all that. But you know what that shidduch is going to do? That's a meaningful, absolutely life-changing activity that the Rashash did. It turned around this guy's life, and that is exactly why Hashem couldn't let us leave Egypt with no money. Because we were totally downtrodden, enslaved, or beaten, cruelly degraded. They were doing menial labor. We weren't given any kavod, no dignity, nothing, not even treated like good human beings. Hashem said, you guys are princes. You guys are mamlecha kohanim. And you better be seen as such. And I'm going to make sure that the non-Jews, the Egyptians, everybody's going to see you as that. You're going to dress like royalty. You're going to get leave with a lot of wealth. You're going to leave with all the animals and cattle because you deserve it. Hashem had to make sure this was a way of restoring their dignity to every single Jew, that they should be called B'nai Yisrael Melachim. Everybody should be feeling like a king. They can't leave as feeling like slaves. Yes, Inu V'Avdum V'Tam. It's part of the Kaisa formation of the Jews. We had to have the slavery, not as a punishment, but as a formation of the Jews, as Kur Barzel, but doesn't matter. Hashem had to restore our dignity. We shouldn't feel like we're still slaves. Now, I had from some ideas about the Haggadah. Let's go through now. One thought here. I'll share your screen. One thought with Avir Yaakov, Buchatzera, and then the Rav Yaakov Buchatzera, and then we're going to go another point in Halach Ma'anya. Okay? Halach Ma'anya, we're up to Magid. Okay. I'm going to mention some things right now just to put the Haggadah in order. You know, hold on. Yeah. Halach Ma'anya, the Avir Yaakov says, if you count the words, says it's 28 words. Now, on the footnotes, they say it's not. If you look carefully, it's 31 words. What do you mean, 28 words? So he's not counting the Hebrew words. Okay, so which Hebrew phrase is he not counting? He's not counting Lashon Haba. Lashon Haba is Hebrew. And the Rishonim said that was added. You know why they added it? Because they did in Bavel, Halach Ma'anya, in Aramaic, so Hashem should listen directly, not through the angels, because the angels don't understand Aramaic. But they also didn't want the Goyim to understand, because in Bavel they spoke Aramaic, so the Goyim understood them. But they're going to say, oh, this year we're here in Bavel, next year we're going to Jerusalem, so then the Goyim would understand, and the Goyim would say, hey, they're revolting, they're rebelling. So they said Lashon Haba in Hebrew. So discount the words Lashon Haba, and then also the word D is just a preposition. Diachalu Abatan. So it's 28 words. What is 28? 28, as we talked about in other shiurim, sometimes 28 is a miloy of a miloy of Hashem's name. It also corresponds to the first pasuk in the Torah is 28. The first pasuk in Seder Dibrot is 28. The first pasuk in the Torah is 7 words, but 28 letters. Verse of the Seder Dibrot, 28 letters. The Kaddish, the Amin Yesh Merabah, 28 letters, and 28 words is the whole extension the Sfarim say. It's also Koach, first part of Chachma, and also Yadid, that's another name for the Beit HaMikdash, or Klai Yisrael and the light. That's what the beauty of all the Gematriot, of what Halach Ma'anya encapsulates. Now, here's a question, maybe we'll get back to later, but just to put in your mind, what does it mean, Diachalu Avatana Mi'arad Yisrael, the Da'arad Mitzrayim, that we ate matzah in Egypt? We ate matzah in Egypt? Or we ate bread in Egypt, we ate matzah leaving Egypt. The Gra, in fact, says we did eat matzah in Egypt. That's Ibn Ezra's opinion. We did eat matzah in Egypt. And how do I know? Because the Gematria of Lachma Anya is 210. For 210 years, we ate matzah. Interesting Gematria. That's the Gra. But there's another opinion. We're going to get to the Avir Yaakov. Okay? The first thing going really back to Kadesh is like this. We'll fly through these points now. Is we have a phrase that we say in the Kadesh is Romam Tanim Kol Am. Hashem took us out from all the nations. We're totally, totally different. And Roshach from Panovich said, you know why we don't make the bracha Sha'asani Yisrael that Hashem made us Jewish? We say Shalos Ani Goy. Why? He said, because there's no one that can make you Jewish. It's up to you. You have to be the one that sparks that fan, that fans that spark, that takes the neshama inside of you, and Asani Yisrael, makes yourself a Jew. Rabbi Franz has a beautiful idea. There's a Yerushalmi says we have four cups. Anybody know where the four cups during the theater come from? Trivia. Okay, that's good. Also, we have the Chagadiyah, we have the Mecham Yodea. Where are the four? There are four Lashonot. Four Lashonot Gula. Who can know? Who could say them? Oh, we got Hesedi. It's all the Gabi Lakati. four Lashon Agula. The Yerushalmi says there's also four. Where's the four? If Yerushalmi, Perek Yud, in Psachim. Arba Psachim, in Yerushalmi, it says the Makor of Arba Kosot is four Kosot of the Sar Mashkim and Sar Ofim. What's that? It's random. That because Paro had four cups that he was drinking, so we're going to do four cups on the Seder. What's the point? Anybody know? Jake, you look like you have the answer.
Yeah, I stumbled upon this verse last year. I'm pulling it up in my notes.
Okay, I'll wait. Or I could say my answer, and then you'll say yours. You want to say? You have it.
It's the same answer with the that the Yerushalmi brings down with the Sar Mashkim Saro theme. I think I shared it at the Seder last year as well. Here, I got it right here. Hold on. Is it about like how they spoke out each of their stories?
Excellent. I love it. As Jakey is saying, when the Sar HaOfim spoke, he spoke in passive. He nay. Once upon a time this happened, I was standing there, and I wasn't, he doesn't even say standing there. He says, there was bread, and there were birds, and the birds came and took it. He said, that's not what the Sar Mashkim says. The Sar Mashkim says, I took those grapes, and I squeezed them, and I put them in a cup, and I grabbed that cup, and I gave it to Paro. He said, that's a person with a vision. That's going to happen. That's going to come to fruition. It's not going to come to fruition. You speak, once upon a time this happened, we're all plain and flat and not excited, not passionate. That's the lesson of the four cups. We have the four cups of Gula. We hope there's going to be Gula. We have to believe what we're saying, that there's going to be Gula. And then there will be a Gula. A beautiful mashal, the Ben Ish Chai says, and this is the lesson of Halach Ma'anya. Halach Ma'anya represents Chametz HaMatzah. What makes the difference in Chametz HaMatzah? The time, everybody knows, the yeast makes it rise, the rising represents the Yetzer Hara. The Maharal says, you know what really distinguishes Matzah and Chametz? Is that Chametz represents freedom. You're free from any bond, anything that's keeping you bound to anything. The Chametz is very poor, very plain. And something that's very, very plain and poor is not bound by restrictions. A guy who's poor, for example, a guy who's homeless, he has very little restrictions. Nobody tells him where to be, when he wants, where to be, at what time he should be. There's no obligations. Now, being a poor man that's homeless is not the ideal. That's not my musar. Everybody should go become homeless. Chas v'shalom. No. But we can take a lesson from that homeless person. For him to move, it's a piece of cake. He just picks up his little garbage can. He goes across the street. What does it mean for a guy with a mansion to move? It's really a pain in the neck. He has to pick up, box up all his stuff. He has to take care of it, get movers, make sure nothing breaks. That's what a rich person, and the scheduling for a rich person is really difficult because he's so busy, he has so many daggot, so many things on his mind. That, says the Maharal, is what makes a person free, is that they're removed from all the gashmiut that's saying, you have to worry about this, you have to take care of that. That's the lesson of the Chametz, is to be free from all the obligations that the Yetzer Hara gives us. Yes, we're supposed to have responsibilities about money. We're supposed to have responsibilities of this world, to be able to channel them in the right way. But they should be under our control, not Gashmiut controlling us. We have to be the Matzah that's pushing down the Yetzer. We're taking control over. Says the Ben Ish Chai, once there was a man, rich man, on a horse coming, riding into the city, and saw a lame person that couldn't walk on the side of the road, limping one step after another. And he says to the lame man, he said, do you need a ride? He says, sure, I'd love a ride. I'm trying to go to the city. He says, wow, the city is 3 miles away from here. It's going to take you forever. He said, yeah, that's how I go from place to place. I'm poor, I'm lame, I have no way to get anywhere. He says, okay, so come for a ride. The rich man brings him on his horse, helps him up, and says, you know what, I'm happy to do a chesed. You know, you can sit in front, you hold the reins of the horse, and I'll sit behind you. Great, so they ride on their way to the city. They get into the city. The rich man tells the lame man, he says, you know, now we got into the city. I brought you here already. Please come off the horse. Now it's time to come off. The lame man says, you're telling me to come off? And he starts screaming, everybody, look, There's this evil, cruel man. He's taking a handicapped person and he's trying to steal his horse. He's trying to pull me off the horse. I can't even walk. And everybody starts gathering around and they see this rich guy on the back of the horse. And the poor guy says, "Look, I'm holding on to the reins. This is my horse." And this rich guy who's strong is trying to steal my horse and throw me off. The end of the story, the Beis Chai says, "Oh, they went to the rabbi, and the rabbi said to the rich person, the chazakah is in his hands. You claim you gave it to him. Why'd you give it to him?" The Beis Chai says, same is with the Yetzer Hara. There's no problem with having involvement in the world. The question is, do you give the reins over to the Yetzer Hara, or you're the one sitting in front? There's no problem being the ani rochev al chamor. The Mashiach is going to come riding on a donkey on chamriyut. Chamor is a lashon of chomer, of things of base, a form of the gashmiut of material. We can be involved in the physicality, but we have to be we have to be rochev. We have to go on top of the gashmiut. It would be like the matzah, not that it lifts us up and the matzah takes over our life and it's holding the reins. If it chooses what we're going to want, if the Yetzer Hara is choosing the media that we're watching, it's choosing the advertisements that we're seeing, so it has the reins in its hands, it has the chazakah. Who's really in control? So the Avir Yaakov said the answer with Halach Ma'ani, he says an interesting thing. Very fascinating. This is about Gilgulim. If you catch it, wonderful. If it's complicated, don't worry. It's very complicated for myself. So I was just going to say just the idea of it. It says when Adam Rishon sinned for 130 years, he didn't have another child. That's what it says in Rashi and Chumash, the Midrash, until he had Sheth. For 130 years, he didn't have another child. And he says that because of those 130 years, he didn't have more children in that time. Yeah, and he didn't do tshuva in that time. It was a big sin. The sin of Chet Adam Rishon. He ate from the tree. For 130 years, he didn't do full tshuva. And the Lashon of Aniya, Halach Ma'anya, is a gematria of 130. The tikkun of Mitzrayim was to fix the sin of Adam Rishon. It took three generations, this is not Rizal, to fix it. And they didn't fix it. It didn't work in the Gulim of the door of Mabul, didn't work. It didn't work in the door of Sodom. It didn't work in the door of Haflagah. That was the door of Migdal Bavel. And he said, comes Mitzrayim, we had to fix all of them. How do we fix all of them? We had the gezerot of all of them upon us in Mitzrayim. That's what we suffered. In Mitzrayim, kol b'nei or teshlichu, we were throwing the babies into the water, like in the door of Mabul. We also had avodah kasheh b'chomer levinim, we were making bricks. You know what? Who else made bricks? That was the door of the Migdal Bavel. And we had basically worthless bricks that were made into towers that fell down. But yet, we had that gezerah. We also had the gezerah of the babies being killed at birth. And that's comparable with the terrible cruelties that were in Sodom. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us those trials and tribulations to be mitakein, all the things that we had in mitakein and Mitzrayim. And we ate Halach Ma'anya. He says Halach Ma'anya is representative of the tikkun of that sin. Lechem is also a gematria of three times of Havaya, of Hashem's name. 26 times 3 is how much? And with that, I'm going to finish with the complicated part, and I'll get the stories, and we'll make a siyum. Okay, how much is 3 times 26? Anybody still awake at this hour? Seventy-eight, that's Lechem. Okay. Melech is also how much? Yes, that has to do with people that dip three times in the salt. Okay, that we do that for the Shem Hashem, Rachamim, three times to break the lechem. Okay, but here's the story, and then we're going to finish. I know it's not such an organized shiur, it just has some ideas on my mind. So, there is a story that we tell in the Haggadah. Maisa Rabbi Eliezer and his Chavirim were learning Torah, and they were learning until the very next morning. And the question is, why were they learning so well? Why were they learning so hard? They know the story. They need to go over it in depth for the whole night. What was that all about? So the Pashut idea is, they were in their 70s and 80s. They've been learning Torah for a really long time, but nothing stopped them. It was always new in the Mechudash. Rav Moshe Feinstein was once asked, how do you know Torah so well? He said, because if you ever saw a purple elephant flying in the air, would you forget about it? He said, absolutely not. Says Rav Moshe, every line in Tosfot for me is like that purple elephant flying. Moshe Rabbeinu saw a burning bush, and he turned, and he looked, and he stared. He said, 80 years old, nothing, you know, he had a lot of experience in his life, nothing should be so new to him. But yet he turned, because Sar Lahabid, he turned to look, Hashem showed him the Shekhinah. He was always curious. When Hashem told Moshe to write the Torah, the Midrash says he was writing, and he had a little bit of ink left over. And the Midrash says, Moshe asked Hashem, what am I supposed to do with this ink? There's a little bit of ink left at the end. He said, take that ink, put it on your forehead. What happened? He did that. He took the ink, put it on his forehead. Midrash says, the nath happened, the ink turned into a shining or panim, turned into keren or panav, a shining glow like the sun from his face. Everybody couldn't even see him. He had to put on a mask like it was corona. Why? My question is, why did Hashem leave over a little ink? Hashem calculates all the DNA a person needs to live his entire life. Hashem figured out the very moment to apply something needs to come out of Mitzrayim. Hashem figured out to the very millimeter that the sun needs to be away from Earth for us to exist. But Hashem couldn't figure out how much ink was needed to write the Torah. Hashem had to leave over a little bit. Oh, oops. You know, take that, smear it on your forehead. You know, go rid of it. What's that about? Said Rabbi Friend, he said, you're going to write the Torah from the beginning to the end? You'll write every letter, Moshe. You're going to learn every letter. And you know what? I want you to remember one thing. You're never finished. There's going to be some ink left at the end. You're going to learn a lot of Torah, and you're not done. You're going to take that ink, after you finish, and take it with you. You have to internalize it, make a part of you. And that which you take part with you is going to shine like the sun to everybody else in the world. That's the idea of Maaser Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer was learning Torah. He was old. He didn't need to learn. But he kept learning because Torah doesn't have an end. That's the lesson of many of our Chachamim, the lesson of Moshe Rabbeinu, is you keep learning, keep blowing that spark. Let me just make sure I didn't forget anything because I have just some gems here that I really want to share. One of the story of Hashgacha I have to say, and then we are finished. It goes like this. We say, Baruch Shomer HaTachol, Hashem kept his promise. Hashem calculated the cates, and we figured out that we were able to leave after 400 years, and it was going to be time after the cates came, after 210 years of work, it was like 400 years, or together 400 years from the B'riah B'nei Mitzrayim, including all the different parts of Galut. Okay. We don't always understand why Hashem does things. And we say sometimes, that Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu. We say the Makom, the language of Makom, Rabbi Schwab says, why do we use the language of Makom? Makom is a sad language. Anybody can say any other time we use the language of Makom? Makom Yenachim is a sad language. You're comforting someone who lost something. If someone does poorly in business, the Gemara says, you say HaMakom, Hashem should give you more, fill your losses. In Ashkenazi, there's more, there's Hamakom is Yachzurim Mishibud Lasara Misara Lishibud. Hashem should take care of things. What's Hamakom doing in the Seder? It's a happy time. We're talking wonderful things. Gula. We're talking what? Baruch. And we're talking about the four sons. Baruch Hamakom. So said Rabbi Schwab, he said, because you might sometimes look around your table and see your sons, your family. And you were expecting all the sons to be like the Sadiq Amur. And not everybody's always like, it meets your expectations. Life is not always what you planned it to be. You don't always meet up to your own expectations. But says the Haggadah, HaMakom HaShem exists everywhere. And we need to remember the Dibra Torkenegan Arba Nivanim to four different people, and Hashem spoke to every single person. And there is a purpose for everything, and we shouldn't give up on anything. Once, with the story of the Hashgacha that I want to end with, once there was a group of Jews that escaped from Germany, 1941, and they escaped Germany and got to England. And they used the little money that they had to bribe their way out of Germany to escape the Shoah, the Holocaust, and they got to England. England was part of the Allies parties, but they saw the people that were all German. They looked German, German citizens. They were Jewish, okay, but they suspected them as being spies. So they were thinking of sending them back to Germany. And then the Jews were pleading with them, "Don't send us back to our deaths." The English had Rachmanis. They said, "You know what? We'll put you in prison." The prisons were getting too full. They said, "You know, we're going to send you to one of our colonies. We'll send you to Australia." That was one of the British colonies before then, before the World War II. And they said, "You know what we're going to do? We'll send you with some of the Jewish prisoners and some of the regular prisoners, some of the people that are murderers and other criminals and the thieves. We'll send you with them on a boat." Now, the Germans had U-boats. They had submarines. They were the first to come up with the submarines, and they were using them as warships to sink any boats that would go in the ocean. They said, "We'll send you on this boat. We'll put no signs of Europe, of England on the boat. And if anybody contacts you, just don't reply to them. Hopefully they won't sink your ship and you get there safely." And they're going on the ship, and these criminals, prisoners, the non-Jewish ones, start giving a terrible time, making their lives miserable. These Jews lost all their family members that they left behind in Germany. They were killed. They lost all their wealth because they couldn't take anything with them. Any jewelry they had with them, they used to bribe the German guards to get out. And finally, what they have in their suitcases? Nothing. They had a few pairs of, they had a few little pieces of clothing, and they had diaries, memoirs, they had pictures. The criminals came and asked those Jews, "We know you Jews have money. Give us all your money." They wanted to steal from them on the boat. They couldn't defend themselves. The English didn't give them any police. So these prisoners tied them up, went to their room, started taking all their suitcases, and they saw no money in there. There was just pictures in there. They said, "You poor Jews, you guys don't have anything." They took the suitcases and threw them in the water. Now the Jews were terribly anguished, sad, but they couldn't do anything about it. They were just davening to Hashem that their boat wouldn't sink. Baruch Hashem, their boat got safely and soundly to Australia. And they don't know why Hashem helped them survive and why they had that terrible experience on the boat, but it happened. 40 years later, in 1981, there was a diver off the coast of England that found a sunken U-boat, a sunken submarine. They pulled it up. They looked into everything. They saw it was from Germany in the World War II, and they found a diary in there. It was written in German. They translated it later, and they found it was written by a captain. And the captain said, "One day, we're on our U-boat, and we're given orders to sink any ship that was not German, and we saw a ship that didn't have any declaration of it, and had no signs where it was from. We asked them. We signaled to them over the radio, 'Where are you from?' They didn't respond. We had orders to sink their ship, but we saw the oddest thing I've never seen. There were suitcases floating right next to their boat. We thought something looked strange and fishy about this. We sent out a little secret boat with one person and a diver to go out to check it out. He went out. He got one of those suitcases. He opened it up. He saw the stuff was all written in German. There are German letters in here. He said, "Those guys are probably just some poor abandoned citizens that are lost at sea. Let's leave them alone. And I'm so glad we didn't sink a ship of some poor fellow citizen Germans." Baruch Hashem, the Hashgacha worked out that 40 years before, we didn't understand why Hashem had to make their lives miserable by having their suitcases thrown overboard. In fact, it would save their life. Baruch Shomer Havtachko. We don't always understand why it is, but in the end, we're going to see the vision and understand why everything the way it is. I just want to remember those ideas that we spoke about, that the more that we try to pick up those sparks, the ikar, that's so precious in every person's neshama, that the Seder relates to us, the stories of Hashgacha that happened to us, that we should take and remember them and tell them to our children. We should write them down. We should think about them. How much we see Hashem in our lives, experience them. Even if it's not a major thing, just small things. Appreciating them, thanking Hashem for them. And finally, that we should think about how proud we are of the Jewish people, of our Havat Yisrael. And the Mishnah, this should be a very inspiring, wonderful Pesach Seder. Okay. Chazak Baruch. I'm sorry if it was a little disorganized. I could send my notes after. Any questions or harod, chidushim? Thank you, everybody, for staying on so long.
Hazak baru. Thank you.
Thank you, Sal.
Loved it, Rabbi.
Thank you, Jake, for your chidush at the 4 o'clock. It was great.
No. I love the quick gems. Perfect. The recording.
Yeah, I recorded. I tried going quick. There's a lot of things, but it's the Seder amazing. Is filled. The Seder is so many good things. I got one thing from Rav Chacham David Yosef for the Haggadah, one Rabbi Fran, that was the one that we were saying before. There's a lot of Haggadot, very nice ones out these days. Rabbi Pesach Kron, I have one. All right, Chazak Baruch, thank you, everyone. Okay, have a Chag Kasher V'Sameach.